This lecture was recorded in front of a live audience at the Catholic Medical Association's 2013 Annual Educational Conference in Santa Barbara, California. To purchase additional copies, please contact the CMA at www.cathmed.org.
Now, if I can introduce our first speaker, Father Joseph Howard, and a little bit of background. I'm going to read his bio, but he came up to me at Phoenix and said, "I've got to talk at your conference." And I said, "Anybody this enthusiastic, I have to let him speak." And so we gave him the easiest topic of all, the history of Catholic social justice. And we gave him a long time, 45 minutes. Anyway, Father Joseph Howard is a graduate of Jesuit High School. He is ordained a priest for Shreveport, Louisiana in 1989. He finished college at LSU with a Bachelor's of Science in Biology and Chemistry. While an undergraduate, he was awarded two research grants for original research he conducted in immunogenetics. He finished the seminary at the University of Thomas in Houston at St. Mary's, where the philosopher Dr. Joseph Graham trained him in Thomistic bioethics. He has served as an adjunct professor of moral theology and bioethics at three different universities. He continues to be well published in our Linacre Quarterly and the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly. His research focuses on metaphysics of the human being as related to the dignity of the person regarding the beginning of life and the end of life in clinical situations. In moving to the East Coast, he was appointed director of the American Bioethics Advisory Commission. He served as a principal investigator for over 10 years in research involving brain death, organ procurement, and death of the human person with colleagues in nuclear radiology, medicine, surgery, philosophy, and theology. Father Howard was appointed to the Institutional Review Board at LSU School of Medicine by Chancellor Robert Barish. He has conducted grand rounds at LSU Health Science Center, recently for the Departments of Neurology, Internal Medicine, and Family Medicine, entitled Palliative Sedation, Terminal Sedation, and Slow Euthanasia. Is it Assisted Suicide? Father Howard holds a STL in Moral Theology and Bioethics from Catholic University, where he's a doctoral candidate. The title of his dissertation is The Status of the Human Person, Pre-Implantation Embryo as a Person in the Thought of Carol Wojtyla, John Paul II, in the Light of His Theological Anthropology and Contemporary Molecular Genetics. Without further ado, Father Joseph Howard.
Good morning. Thank all of you for being here today. Let's see how we can. Can somebody help me with the remote here? It's not. No, there we go. Okay. On the night that the Holy Father was elected at LSU, I called the MD, PhD, the head of neuroradiology, who's from Buenos Aires, and I said to him, "You know this man, don't you?" And he said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Tell me everything that you can about him." And he said, "Well, he rules with an ironclad fist. You never cross him." Anyhow, when I did speak to Dr. Brayton in Tucson and wanted to speak, and he said social justice, I recall Dr. Brayton saying, "You're opening up a can of worms." And Dr. Brayton said, "Oh, I know so, but we've got to do it." And my response was, "But I'm afraid that when I speak, they will see me as a liberal heretic." Anyhow, that brings us together today, a conference that is probably long overdue. And one of the first things we began to see with this Pope, from his lifestyle, as well as his teaching, was simplicity. The call for each of us in our unique state of life and whatever our vocation is, to live a simple life and to manifest real and true concern for the poor. At least twice, the Holy Father has made reference to theological narcissism, and he has accused the church of being self-referential, narcissistic, and most recently he stated that there had been a number of popes with their, quote, courtier aides of the court, that we're narcissists. And I think we all know that Pope Francis is reforming the Roman Curia. But several of the statements that he made, I think, are relevant. He tells us that if we do not profess Christ, things go wrong. And when we don't profess Jesus, we profess a worldliness of the devil. He said, when we profess Christ without the cross, we are not true disciples, we are worldly. And we have learned that his personal encounter with the Lord was around age 17, where something radically transformed his life. And he stated that he was moved by Jesus approaching him. The Lord always approaches us first with his infinite mercy. And in this personal, radical encounter, he began to know Jesus and enter the Jesuits and move on. I'm going to share just four brief cases that, as a priest who lives in a parish, have come to me, and these are not uncommon, that show me there's a system in need of reform. Another priest sent a parishioner who was unemployed without health care, and at a health care fair detected a thyroid mass. And when she called LSU to get in, they said, we'll see you initially in 6 months. And with all of my connections to LSU, it took me a good 2 weeks to even get her into the system. And I thought, my gosh, I mean, none of us with a mass on the thyroid would want to wait 6 months for an initial evaluation. Another parishioner came to my office in the rectory wanting or thinking very strongly about committing suicide. Fortunately, in our psychiatry department, we have many Catholic psychiatrists that are faithful. They were out of town. I ended up with a psychiatric resident who said, send him to the ER. He went on his own. He came back to my office 3 hours later. He had only been seen by a PA who discharged him. I then paged the resident back and said I was afraid this would happen. And she said, now you come back to the ER in your collar. And it was a bureaucracy just to go back to get him in, all the red tape. Fortunately, she was able to prevent him from an act of suicide. And then a very devout Catholic physician who had been diagnosed with a metastatic lung cancer after several years was told locally, there's nothing more we can do, go home and prepare to die. Fortunately, through other physicians at MD Anderson in Houston, we were able to consult and get protocols from MD Anderson to be administered in Shreveport and bought him 2 more years of life that were quality. And then finally, a physician who had had a stroke. He noticed a very strange blurriness in his eye. He was admitted. And even with his colleagues, it took 2 to 3 days for a colleague to see him or even look at his MRI scans. He said he was ready to discharge himself. He had somehow fallen through the cracks. And I share these cases to emphasize that not only the poor, but sometimes even physicians are slipping through the cracks. We've got a major problem here. When we turn to the Second Vatican Council documents, which are cited largely Gaudium et Spes and listed in the Catechism, we start with what constitutes the basis for the dignity of the human person. The Catechism, as we all know, was prepared under the pontificate of John Paul II, where, again, he reaffirmed that as individual human beings, we are a composite, a unity of body and soul. And, of course, in the theology of the body, he loves to use the term communio personarum, a communion of persons, referring to the Trinity. We, as humans, are created in the image and likeness of the Trinity, a communion of three divine persons in perfection. And the Catechism tells us that from our very conception, each of us, without exception, are destined for eternal life and beatitude. And that is largely based on our soul, the intellect and free will that each of us as human beings, human persons have, again, in honor of the Blessed Trinity. And the late French Thomistic philosopher Jacques Maritain had it right when he argued that in the person is the soul, which has a greater value than the whole physical universe. Why? Because that soul is immaterial and immortal. It will never be destroyed. Pope Leo XIII, in 1891, responding largely to the problems in the Industrial Revolution, issued the encyclical Rerum Novarum. And in that encyclical, Pope Leo noted that the worker must take precedence over the laws of economics. The state has a duty to protect workers against exploitation. And we know at that time, many of those being exploited immorally were children and women. Leo recognized that there was a right to form trade unions, and he very much opposed any type of revolution. He maintained that political power derives from God, and to disobey civil authority is to rebel against God. Now, that may strike us as a little bit odd today, but Leo was rejecting laissez-faire capitalism. And he was doing so because he said the state has a duty. He didn't specify it in an exact manner. The state has a duty to protect those who are poor or weak or vulnerable. After Pope Leo, we have Pope Pius XI, and now for the first time in his encyclical, he uses the word social justice 8 times, the word common good 6 times, which Dr. Brayton's already referred to, and now for the first time he introduces, quote, subsidiary function. And Pope Pius defines social justice as that one class is forbidden to exclude the other from sharing in the benefits, and wages must be large enough that they support a family. And it's contrary to social justice, he argued, when for personal gain without regard for the common good, wages are excessively raised or lowered. He said the norms of the common good are grounded in social justice, and all of human society must work to conform to the needs of the common good. Now we move to Pope Pius XII, who occupied the papacy from 39 to 58. Some scholars have said, who knows, that not only was he against any form of communism or socialism, but some have argued that he had a pathological fear of it. But one thing we know is that Pope Pius XII was a very strong supporter of Western democracy. And one of his most significant contributions in this arena was he insisted that the right to private property exists, but it is subordinate to the general rights of all people to utilize the goods of the earth, that God meant for all persons to have access to the material resources of creation. Pope John XXIII, who called for the Second Vatican Council, wrote 2 major encyclicals. And he had used a term that was difficult to translate into the vernacular that upset many people at that time. When he used the word socialization, many people thought that it smacked of socialism. Not at all. What he meant by that word was that people now had entered into relationships that were no longer just private and individual. The relationships involved forming associations and being organized on a large scale, hence socialization. And John XXIII, some have argued, moved the church's teaching away, if you will, from a traditional opposition to the welfare state. He called for social justice to be established on an international level, and again, further explicated that principle we're going to hear over and over again of subsidiarity. And not quoting John XXIII, But from my own research, I would note that the natural law's inherent principle of subsidiarity emphasizes the right of the individual to pursue the basic human goods, which also serve the common good. The principle of subsidiarity, as I wrote in one of my doctoral papers for Dr. Joseph Capizzi, who's up next, subsidiarity is part of the moral virtue of justice. And subsidiarity can be understood properly as that higher levels of organizations or bodies should not interfere or replace what lower levels can and should do unless they either cannot or will not do it. Now, when John XXIII issued Pacem in Terris, he went on to define all the innumerable and viable rights of the human person based on the dignity of the human person. The right to life, food, clothing, shelter, rest, medical care, necessary social services, security in case of sickness, inability to work, widowhood, old age, unemployment, and such cases of others who through no fault of their own are unable to work. So now for the first time we have a pope in an encyclical listing all these rights. And again, when these rights are often listed, we'll see today, such as a right to medical care, the magisterium doesn't explain or interpret how that's to come about. And as we'll see hopefully this morning, there are many different ways that can come about, and good folks can come to different conclusions based upon prudence of what means to employ that are appropriate to achieve that good or righteous end. Pope Paul VI continued the Second Vatican Council and wrote Populorum Progressio. And in doing so, Paul VI called for bold transformation of structures on an international economic level. He was opposed to violence and confrontation. His vision might be said to be one of from, quote, top down. And it was interesting that in this particular document, he called for, quote, an effective world authority. That often upsets people who ask, well, whoa, what does he mean by that? And he goes on in this document to explain, quote, as we told you when we spoke to you at the UN in New York, your vocation is not to bring together just some people as brothers and sisters, but rather all people as brothers and sisters. Such international collaboration by all the nations of the world calls for a new juridical order. And what I read that to mean is yes, we have to be concerned about poverty and the poor where we live in our cities and our country, but we also have to realize that there has to be, in some capacity, a concern around the world. Because as John Paul would teach so eloquently, what one does in one place is interdependent and affects those in other places. So I believe Paul VI was calling for a much broader vision. John Paul II attended the Latin American Bishops' Conference in 79 in Pueblo, and in 68 there had been a meeting of the same bishops in Medellin, Colombia, where they had taken steps to describe a preferential option for the poor. And when John Paul attended this and was asked about that, he made several very key remarks. First, that we cannot see Jesus as a political revolutionary figure. Secondly, he argued, yes, there is a preferential option, but not an exclusive one for the poor. Why? Because Jesus came to evangelize everyone, including the rich. So he sort of framed it in a more accurate context. And John Paul went on to say that mercy is not a substitute for justice. And he said that the poor themselves are to be the main agents that will bring about their own advancement and change. In 1981, John Paul II issued the Borum exertions. And in doing that, he began by telling us, going back to the book of Genesis in the Old Testament, that the human person is made in the image of God partly through a mandate, an order from God to, quote, subdue and dominate the earth. This process, the Holy Father argued, is universal and embraces all humans in every capacity, at all times, in every generation. And John Paul said three things occur when the human person engages in work, a mandate. One, he or she transforms nature. Two, in a sense, one becomes more of a, quote, human being. Self-actualization is how I would read that. And thirdly, by engaging in work, one assists in building a constitution that lays, if you will, a foundation for the foundation of the family, which is the basic unit or cell of the life of society. Many times today, people are concerned about poverty and welfare and issues of work. And just briefly, I would mention to you that as I was preparing these slides this past week, I pulled off the interstate right by the rectory. I saw a poor man crippled over with a cane and a sign. I was being paged by one of our OBGYNs who's not here, Dr. Marie Anderson, a very wonderful holy woman. I went to the rectory to take care of that, and then something told me, gosh, I'm preparing this lecture, certainly I can't be a hypocrite. And as my Jesuit spiritual director had taught me, go back, drive the car into the interstate, lower the window, and ask him if he's hungry, and if he is, go to Whataburger and get him food and bring it back. That way, I'm not just handing out money and being scammed. Many times they say no thank you, then you move on. And around that time too, I had a physician consult me who was a devout Catholic surgeon who had seen a patient with acute cholecystitis, no money, no insurance, comes in with nose rings, tongue rings, smartphones, iPads. The physician put the woman on 48 hours of antibiotics. It didn't work. The surgeon decided he needed to do a cholecystectomy, the laparoscopy. That went through, came back, and basically removing stitches, became clear to the physician that the woman had no intent of working out any type of agreement to pay off anything. It was owed to her. And the physician was asking me, you know, how am I to look at this spiritually? Because none of us want to be scammed, and the church doesn't ask us to be exploited. And my response to this surgeon is what my confessor has taught me, is it may happen at times we're taken advantage of, but know that even when that does happen, and we don't want it to happen, the Old and New Testament tell us charity covers a multitude of sins. And when I asked my confessor, what do you mean by that? The response I got was, you will be blessed in this life in ways you can't even imagine for what you've done. So I'm not promoting exploitation or being scammed. It will happen, but as my confessor told me, you know, you did something good even though you may have been taken advantage of. And I think that that's an important point for all of us to remember in our day-to-day work of people who are suffering and in need physically, spiritually, and psychologically. Now, we know that in the 90s, Cardinal Ratzinger, under John Paul II, was head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, and by this time, we had some priests, particularly in Latin America, that were promoting liberation theology. And so Cardinal Ratzinger, under the direction of John Paul II, issued these two documents. Father Leonardo Boff, a Franciscan, had been disciplined by the Vatican. Subsequently, he later left the Franciscan Order of the Priesthood. But one of the important things that Cardinal Ratzinger noted in these documents that were approved by Pope John Paul II, again, is Jesus was not a political revolutionary figure. Jesus came to call us to conversion, that Greek word metanoia, where we are changed from the very marrow, the very core of our being inside, and then and only then manifest it outwards. Some of these priests, Boff and Gustavo Gutierrez, were taking elements of Marxist ideology and in their own analysis sort of blending it into the gospel: violence, class warfare, coup d'etats, overthrowing government. And what the church was saying is, no, this is not reconcilable with Christian doctrine or revelation. Jesus came first and foremost to liberate us from sin, redemption, and salvation. That's the solution. Not violence, not revolution, not class warfare, not coup d'etat. And Boff recently, after Pope Francis was elected, made this statement, quote, Ratzinger was against the cause of the poor, comma, liberation theology, end quote. Not true. Pope Benedict was very much concerned for the poor, but again, prudence. The means to be employed to achieve the end is not to be done in liberation theology that is taking elements of Marxist thinking and trying to fit it into the gospel. There's another way to do it, conversion. Conversion from the inside that then manifests itself with a love and a compassion to reach out to the poor and take care of them and their needs. John Paul II issued two encyclicals that were really prominent. And the first one here, Solicitudo Rei Socialis, he defined this virtue so beautifully that we're going to hear about, that Dr. Brayton's already mentioned, solidarity. This is the best that I could find. Solidarity, he wrote, is that virtue that allows me to see the other, a person, persons, or nations as, quote, my brother, my neighbor, my helper, a sharer with me, one on par with myself. And then he went on to say that there are bureaucratic structures of sins, but he said they're always rooted in personal sin that's linked to concrete acts of individuals who introduce these structures, consolidate them, and make them difficult to remove. In other words, we can't hide behind structures of bureaucracy and say, it's not my fault, I have nothing to do with it. And then in Chantesimus Annus in 1991, John Paul was critical to some degree of the welfare state. He said, yes, it must protect the weak and the weak sectors of society, but not make them dependent upon it. If we do that, or we fail to stop it, we cripple them, because all, as John Paul taught in Laborum Exercens, are called to work. That's in the very nature of our being. And then John Paul distinguished two forms of capitalism. And he said, if by capitalism you mean an economic system that has a fundamental positive role for business, market, private property, responsibility for means of production with human creativity and an economic sector, yes, the church approves that, but personally he said he liked to call it a free economy. However, if by capitalism you mean a system that has freedom in the economic sector that is not circumscribed within a strong juridical framework, which places it at the service of human freedom in totality and sees it as a particular aspect of freedom that is religious and ethical, no. Strong juridical framework. Again, that's not explained or interpreted, it's only stated. And another one of the great contributions that John Paul made in 88 was in Christe Fidelis Laici, where he sort of tied together all of the rites and their interrelationship. Quote, the common outcry that is often justly made today on human rights to life, to home, to work, to family, and culture is false and illusory if the right to life, the most basic and fundamental condition for all other personal rights, is not defended with maximum determination. That makes sense to me, because now he's telling us all of these other social rights we're talking about become false and illusory if the right to life at the very beginning is not defended and protected in a maximum context. And so we all know that Pope John Paul II was a prolific writer, and we could probably spend several lifetimes just trying to penetrate his thought and understand all of his thinking. In the Catechism under John Paul II, the Catechism defines social justice as the respect for the human person and rights flowing from human dignity which guarantee it. Society must provide the conditions that allow people to obtain what is their due according to their nature and vocation. And again, Dr. Brayton brought up common good, comps for my graduate work at Catholic U. Dr. Capizzi was one of the examiners. Gaudium Spes defines the common good as the sum of those conditions of social life which allow social groups and their individual members relatively thorough and ready access to their own fulfillment. So yes, that includes me as an individual, but me also in relationship to all other individuals. St. Thomas, interestingly, defines that there are two species of justice: commutative, which is the order of one part to the other, one private person to another, and distributive, the order of the whole towards the parts, in other words, that which belongs to the community in relationship to each single person. Now, we all know that Pope Benedict, he certainly did not write as prolifically as John Paul II, but he did write in 09, Caritas in Veritate, a very lengthy document dealing with social ethics and justice. And one of the things that he noted was that the two key moral principles in 09 that needed to be focused upon, Benedict said, were justice and the common good. And he said, one of the problems we're having right now in this era of history in business is profit being exclusive or largely the exclusive motive. And he said, this is really grounded, if we're going to diagnose it philosophically, in utilitarianism and forms of hedonism and consumerism. Hedonism, whatever feels good, do it, which we know has been alive and well and operative for a number of decades. And Pope Benedict maintained that the best antidote, the most effective antidote against an all-encompassing welfare state would invoke subsidiarity and solidarity. These two key virtues we see over and over again in the papal encyclicals and the catechism. I'm going to give you a model of social justice that's dear to me from back home. This book is written by the daughters of Dr. Alice and Dr. Joe Holobeck, who met in medical school. They were in Shreveport. They're both deceased, gone on to their heavenly reward. And it's a wonderful book that will show you two young medical students falling in love that were Catholic, their love for God, their love for the church, their love for the poor, their morals, their values, their thinking, their ideology. And it really gives us a modern day example of one model. I'm not saying the only model, but one model of social justice. And when I had finished my studies in pre-med and decided that I was going to sort of make a transition into the seminary to be a priest, and I could immediately sense from the very start bioethics would blend, they were there for me because I collected blood in a Catholic hospital as a phlebotomist in pre-med, where I met Dr. Joe. And of course, phlebotomists are all over the floor, so I would have tons of questions of, you know, what is a differential on a CBC and what are liver enzymes? And of course, Dr. Joe loved to teach. And they had a very special, in my view, understanding of the poor, even back in the days of civil rights. They saw any and every patient, regardless of whether they believed in God or their religion, whether they had money, insurance, Medicaid, or Medicare. And I'm not saying that you have to do that. I'm simply using the Holobex as one example, and there are many other different ways to practice and engage in social justice. And our previous bishop, the one who ordained me, when Dr. Alice died, told the Shreveport Times, she always practiced medicine in a way that always showed true care and dignity for the poor. And these, I learned from their daughter, were in difficult days in civil rights, where in a physician's office, African Americans were supposed to sit in one waiting room and whites in another. They were in the middle of that, and I believe that they had literally a vision from God, a vocation, a mission, a missionary activity, where they had an understanding that many may not have liked, but they knew it was the righteous and virtuous thing to do, and they did it. Now, the magisterium of the church in the catechism tells us some of the duties we as individual citizens and political leaders have. One, the political community, it states, must assist, note that word assist in the catechism, in the rights of the family and the persons involving, for example, private property, work, housing, and the right to medical care. Concern for the health care of its citizens requires that society help, and again, note that word, help in the catechism, help others in the attainment of living conditions such as health care, 2288. And then it goes on to say, while morality requires respect for the life of the body, this is not an absolute moral value. For example, the catechism says it rejects the neo-pagan notion promoting the cult of the body, that is, sacrificing everything to idolize physical perfection. That's a problem we have today in our country. The negation of the spiritual life in place of only the physical. So what we're going to do now is sort of look at another model from Dr. William May. Many of you, if not all of you, have certainly heard of Dr. May, who is a wonderful Thomistic moral philosopher. And about 20 years ago, Dr. May addressed John the 23rd's statement of this right to medical care in publication. And Dr. May maintained these points, which make sense to me. May argued that all who are able have a duty to help the sick. But there are a variety of ways that this can be carried out. There's no single black or white way to do it. May says the obligation to honor the right of the poor to health care is a duty first and foremost upon citizens, you and I. And one of our duties, and the way we exercise that, according to Professor May, is to move our legislators, locally and nationally, to enact laws that make certain that the poor have equitable access to health care. And then May addresses, but what type of health care are the poor entitled to? He says, certainly, minimally and fundamentally, at least, basic health care that we would have for our own children, our own families. And then May says, for those who have been charged with a power, an authority that's political and economic, they have an obligation to refrain from using it to skew the system to their own advantage, which disadvantages the poor or those in need. Again, to me, that makes sense. And May published this in 1989, the year I was ordained a priest in ethics and medics, part of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You know, secular humanists, and I know many of them who were raised Catholic, who are bright lawyers and doctors who've left the church, often approach me and say, I feed the poor. How am I doing anything different than what Mother Teresa's sisters do? We're both doing the same thing. Again, back to Dr. Capizzi, fundamental moral theology, which I had under him in directed research, and the notion or nature of the fundamental moral act. The acts look the same. Secular humanist, who define themselves, well, I know there's something out there, some sort of God, but I really don't know what it is or how to connect with it. And so for all practical purposes, it's irrelevant in my daily life. If I just do good things to people, what's the problem? I'm feeding the poor, Mother Teresa is. But what makes those acts distinct is the second component of intent or intentionality. Mother Teresa would tell us, when I see the naked in Calcutta, emaciated with parasitic infections, sick and hungry, I can look into their face and have some sort of vision or image of Jesus in them, and that motivates me to respond. Now, I can't sit here and tell you that I had that image when I look at the poor. But when I pulled off that interstate, I had somewhat of a sense I've got to try something. And my conscience would not let that go. So Mother Teresa's sisters are motivated by seeing in the poorest of the poor the face of Jesus. Secular humanists tell me we feed them just because it's the good thing to do. Not the same moral act. They look the same externally, but they, in fact, are very different. In my diocese, and probably many, if not most throughout the country, we have Catholic Charities. And while we help the poor, at least in my diocese, there are requirements that for ongoing help, they must sign up with Catholic Charities to take classes, to learn how to manage money, seek education, and get employment. Again, that makes sense to me. John Paul II, Chantesimus Annus. Don't make them dependent on the welfare state. Don't cripple them. They too are called by God in a mandate to work. So I think that Mother Teresa really left us not only an example, but a tremendous legacy, which her sisters continue. And though we may not see the face of Jesus literally, or even more metaphorically as she did, we are at least called to develop, I believe, a sense of the poor and Christ's presence within them in a special way. As I conclude today, I would do so with some of the remarks of Pope Francis in his first encyclical Lumen Fidei, The Light of Faith. Pope Francis tells us that Dante in the Divine Comedy, after he professes his faith, recognizing Saint Peter, Dante says that he describes a light of Christ, as a spark which then sort of grows to become a burning flame, like a heavenly star, he argued, that literally glimmered within him. Pope Francis says, the light of faith does not make us oblivious or forgetful to the suffering in the world. Mother Teresa, Pope Francis said, and St. Francis of Assisi understood this so profoundly. They knew they could not eradicate all pain and suffering or explain all evil. To those suffering, the Holy Father says, God does not provide brilliant arguments that explain everything in the mystery of suffering. But rather, Pope Francis says, we, and I think this is applicable to you as physicians in healthcare, are called in a special way to be an accompanying presence to your patients, never abandoning them, but accompanying them as a beacon or a ray, a light of hope until the very end. Suffering, he said, reminds us, each of us, that faith's service to the common good is always one of hope. Beautiful words in these difficult days. As a priest of Jesus Christ, I want to thank each of you personally for your work as physicians and healthcare professionals. And know that I am always there with you on a daily basis, first praying for you, and then literally fighting for your rights to practice medicine that are given to you by Jesus Christ, the divine physician. And as a priest, I thank you in his name for all you do and for being at this conference. God bless each and every one of you.
This lecture has been brought to you by the Catholic Medical Association and recorded by Optimum Productions of Atlanta, Georgia. To purchase additional copies, please contact the CMA at www.cathmed.org.